behind on the calendar. We are addressing our third issue, or excuse me, our third case set for today. I'll ask our marshal to call the case.
Calling A241760, Jeffrey John Walker, appellant, versus City of Afton, respondent.
Counsel, just a reminder, 15 minutes each, 5 minutes for rebuttal. State your name and indicate who you're speaking on behalf of. We had appellant counsel when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Joseph Vaccaro. I'm here for the appellant in this matter, Jeffrey John Walker. This case presents a very simple question for the court, and I believe it's well addressed by the case law cited in my brief, that there is simply no applicable statute of limitations for a declaratory judgment action.
I thought you were only doing the promissory estoppel for our appeal purposes.
The promissory estoppel is coupled to a declaratory judgment action. Promissory estoppel, a declaratory judgment action is simply a mechanism by which a litigant can fashion what would otherwise be a defense into a cause of action and to bring it before the court. The purpose is this exact situation we have here, where the City of Afton has contended for years that Mr. Walker is creating a nuisance by virtue of its ordinance, yet it has refused to bring a civil action to abate that nuisance. The purpose of the declaratory judgment statute is that it allows Mr. Walker to do exactly what he did here, which is to say, I don't wish to have this claim hanging over my head, and I'm going to bring what would otherwise be my defense, which is promissory estoppel, as a declaratory judgment action so that the court can construe whether or not I am actually permitted to do this on the basis of promissory estoppel. And because of that, there is simply no applicable statute of limitations because it is purely a defense. Quite simply, if instead of Mr. Walker initiating this suit, the city had initiated this suit, there would be no question that if Mr. Walker had pled the affirmative defense of promissory estoppel, there would be no statute of limitations that would bar that defense. The case law does say that there...
What case? So I appreciate your argument. I think like the city's counterclaim, you're saying we would have that your client could raise promissory estoppel as a pure defense to the counterclaim, right?
That's correct. And the case law does... Oh, I'm sorry for interrupting.
What case best matches the situation we have here, which is that a party brings a DEC action thinking that in the future it may need to assert a defense to a claim? What case is that?
Well, that's what a declaratory judgment action is for, is that someone is saying, you are in breach of our contract. If you do this, you will be in breach of our contract. And the person says, for example, here, well, you made me a promise that you wouldn't enforce this provision of the contract, and rather than risk the damages that would run from that breach, the person brings a declaratory judgment action coupled to a claim of promissory estoppel.
Okay, but, yeah, so let's deal with the... I'm just wondering, I understand what the DEC action is for, but I'm wondering what case... Is there a case, and maybe there is, one on all fours here, where, let's leave aside the counterclaim because it's not before us, where the person, based on a theory of promissory estoppel or breach of contract or whatever, brings the DEC action outside the statute of limitations that would exist for that action, outside of a pure defense mode or framework?
Sure. I don't believe there is such a case. There are cases where the court has said that someone has brought both a declaratory judgment action and an offensive cause of action seeking damages, and the statute of limitation does apply. But the case law is very clear that absent any sort of claim of damages, and no damages were sought under this count of promissory estoppel, there is no statute of limitations for the very, very basic reasoning that I've laid out here, which is that if the state had sought to abate this nuisance and was instead the plaintiff in this case instead of the defendant, there would be no question that there would be no statute of limitations that would apply to Mr. Walker's promissory estoppel defense, which he's free to raise under the rules of civil procedure, as I cite in my brief.
Mr. Vaccaro, is your argument consistent with the Weavewood opinion of the Supreme Court?
That case is not ringing a bell with me. I'm sorry.
Cited in respondent's brief,
the opening paragraph from 2012, the opening paragraph says, we conclude that an action for declaratory judgment is barred by an applicable statute of limitations to the same extent that the same cause of action would be barred in a non-declaratory proceeding.
Sure, and my position is consistent with that because promissory estoppel can both, it's a contract doctrine that imputes a contract where none exists. So a person is free to argue that a contract, that they're entitled to damages for breach of a contract in the same way they're free to argue that the contract relieves them of waiver, something like that. So here, estoppel is not being raised as an affirmative cause of action. It's being raised as a defense. And as a defense,
well,
it's not barred by any statute of limitations.
Stop you once. Count two of your complaint is captioned promissory estoppel, right?
Correct.
And, I mean, you dismissed counts one and three.
That's correct.
So you're proceeding under count two, which is labeled promissory estoppel. So, okay, let's...
And the reason it is labeled as that is because you can't sue someone for just simply declaratory judgment. You need to provide in your pleadings clarification on what basis you're seeking declaratory judgment. It's not a situation like negligence or assault where the elements or what's being contested are just known by the name. The declaratory judgment statute doesn't list out the elements of receiving a declaratory judgment statute. Promissory estoppel is pled to make clear that the basis on which we are seeking a declaratory judgment is promissory estoppel.
Can I ask too? So you, I see in the record, there's both your original complaint signed, and I don't know when it was, well, here, let me be specific about it. The original complaint was signed in September of 2023, filed later. And then you filed a document labeled amended complaint. I'm just wondering, was there an order permitting or granting leave to amend, or is that?
Yes, there was an oversight on my part at the time. The motion for judgment on the pleadings was filed. We did receive an order from Judge Meslow that we were to file a complaint, and he did permit me to file an amended complaint to clarify that the various counts had been dismissed out and some other things that were discussed on the record at that hearing. That's why the complaint is labeled amended complaint.
And that's a written order from Judge Meslow?
It was an oral order.
At a hearing? Do we have a transcript of that hearing?
I don't believe we have a transcript of that hearing.
So how do we know that you have leave to amend the complaint?
It wasn't objected to by the other party. I guess I'd
represent. There's no record of that. And I guess, but then my other question have to do is that you added a sentence to count two, which says, in the document labeled amended complaint, which says this is a request for a declaratory judgment. So did the district court specifically authorize that?
Yes, it was. It analyzed it, and we discussed specifically that there was a request for declaratory judgment. And in the original complaint, there were no monetary damages constructed. The request for relief was an order construing Mr. Walker's rights in favor of giving him the ability to use his property as an airport on the basis of promissory estoppel. There was never a request for damages attached to that complaint. To that count, not the complaint, to that count. There was at one point a request for damages attached to the complaint, but the counts that under which damages were sought were dismissed.
So do you concede that if a statute of limitations applies, then your count two is untimely?
I don't know how a statute of limitations could apply because...
Oh, my premise. Let's just accept my premise for a moment. If a statute of limitations applies to count two, is count two untimely?
I don't even think we need to get to the affirmative defense of statute of limitations because if a statute of limitations would apply, count two would fail on its own simply because it doesn't plead for damages. He has no... it doesn't plead a cause of action.
I mean, the procedural posture of this case is that the defendant... pleaded, I believe, the affirmative defense of statute of limitations. There was a motion for dismissal, motion for judgment on the pleadings, and, you know, with focus on the statute of limitations issue. And so that's why you argued at the outset that there is no, the concept, I think what you're arguing is that the whole concept of statute of limitations cannot apply to a declaratory judgment.
That's correct. I mean, I would concede that it would
be... If you're wrong about that.
What's that?
If you're wrong about that, I'm just trying to simplify the issues.
I mean, what I would say,
if you're wrong about that, would you concede that you did not commence this action within 6 years?
If Mr. Walker was trying to sue for promissory estoppel and receive damages, yes, that would be time barred. But he's no more time. But he's not time barred again. This is a current ongoing dispute. Mr. Walker is continuing to use this property and wishes to use this property as an airport.
Wait a minute. So, and I hate to stir the pot, but if this is a continuing ongoing dispute, didn't you have to also appeal the permanent injunction that was issued against him from using the property as an airstrip?
My understanding would be is that if the court's judgment was to be vacated, there may be some sort of injunction put in place during the course of litigation.
Well, there is a permanent injunction, and your time to appeal that would have presumably in November.
I misspoke. I was talking about at the time this action is ongoing, there was a dispute about whether Mr. Walker was legally allowed to use this property as an airport. As a result of that order for judgment, an injunction was put in place. But if that order for judgment is vacated, then there would be a continuing live dispute. At the time this action was filed,
you're saying that if we rule in your favor on this appeal, that undoes the injunction that was filed?
Not necessarily immediately, but if Mr. Walker was to prevail and it was to be found that that the city was promissorily stopped from enforcing its ordinance, it's hard to see how an injunction could be put in place against him.
Well, it's in place and it's permanent, so I don't know how this court can undo that. Had you appealed it, perhaps I can see that, but I'm trying to understand the reason.
I mean, I think there are other procedural mechanisms if we got to that point whereby Mr. Walker could seek relief under Rule 60 to undo that injunction for other grounds justifying relief. I don't really think that that's the question here, because one follows naturally from the other that if the order is vacated and Mr. Walker prevails back at the district court on the grounds of promissory estoppel, there would be no legal basis to issue an injunction forbidding him from using the property as an airport.
I think the challenge I want to hear from both parties on this, when I look at Weavewood, the Supreme Court said, you know, that the statute of limitations, the underlying claim applies as well to a deck action, but when it's a pure defense, the statute of limitations doesn't apply. And then it sent it back to this court to decide whether the claims that were asserted in that case were pure defenses or not.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a foreclosure by advertisement, you know, and could the mortgagor bring claims under there? We went through each of them, and we mm-hmm. decided, yeah, there are some that are pure defense. And then we had another non-precedential decision where we, again, in the context of a foreclosure. So in both those cases, where there was like a notice of intent to foreclose for failure to pay, et cetera, in both of those cases, the other party had started some. It was clear, plain that there was going to be actions. They were already started or they were imminent. The question for me is, does the case law just permit, what action was already started, like at this time this claim was brought, knowing that your client knew that he imminently faced action against him such that I need to bring this deck action as a pure defense? Because I don't know that the case law doesn't yet say, if you're worried about it in the future, you can bring the deck action just generally.
So I guess I'm trying to understand your question. I think the difference between a foreclosure and the situation we face here is that, you know, a foreclosure is not a moment in time, but there is a distinct beginning and an end of a foreclosure. You know, foreclosure proceedings are commenced and they end. They have a definite end date. Here we have property that's being used as an airport, and that use has been ongoing. It's been the subject of criminal litigation, but the criminal litigation didn't answer the question of whether or not the property was permitted to be used that way. All the criminal litigation answered was, when Mr. Walker was acquitted, that the state hadn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt that he had used the property that way. The controversy was still ongoing and was still live at the time of that this action was filed.
What controversy, though? Like, what action had been taken, initiated besides the criminal complaints on this his use of the airstrip?
Oh, the city hadn't taken any sort of action against him. It had just simply put him on notice that it viewed this as a non-conforming use, but it was sitting on its rights and not bringing any sort of civil action to abate the nuisance and to clear this matter up and once and for all and to fully determine whether or not Mr. Walker was permitted to use this by the promises that had been made to them city. Mr. Walker initiated this civil suit. So on the day this case was filed, there was still a controversy that the city had not brought before the court about whether or not Mr. Walker, the representations made by the city and its representatives to Mr. Walker, gave him the ability to use this property as an airport. And that's why the action is timely.
And were those actions by the city, I mean, were they immediately prior to the commencement of the action, or are you going back years, or what?
Mr. Walker was acquitted in this matter in February, I believe, of 2023, and the initial complaint was served on him in November of that same year.
And you'll have your rebuttal.
The complaint. Yep.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry, Judge Johnson.
What complaint was served on him?
The initial complaint was served in this matter in November of that same year, and that was filed sometime. Then the action was filed sometime later, in the beginning of 2024, or the end of 23.
I thought you commenced this case.
I did, but it was initially filed by the city. The city filed their answer before I filed.
You commenced it with service.
The service, yes, in November of 23.
And that was 2 months after the acquittal, then?
No, not two. The acquittal was in February, so it was...
Oh, sorry?
It was 9 months or so after the acquittal.
And was there any other, I would say, like threats or statements by the city toward him during that interval? That's in the record, as far as we know.
Not in the record. No, there's nothing in the record that indicated any more threats from the city between him in February and November. No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Jack Brooksbank, here today representing respondent, the City of Afton. I'd like to start off just with a couple of brief notes about what this case is not about. We heard at length that this is a claim for declaratory judgment. Contrary to some representations this morning, appellant did file a cause of action for declaratory judgment. That was count one of the original complaint. And that was voluntarily dismissed. So this is not a declaratory judgment action. This is an action for promissory estoppel. Secondarily, we've heard that this is brought as an affirmative defense to the city's action. And at the district court, there was one argument that was raised regarding affirmative defenses, and that was that the city had failed to disprove the existence of affirmative defenses, which, of course, completely reverses the actual standard of proof. It is the burden of the party asserting an affirmative defense to prove all of the necessary elements. So to the extent that it is attempted to be raised as an affirmative defense, that is done for the first time before this court, and it is therefore forfeit. Rather, we're here talking about count two of the complaint, as Your Honor observed, which is titled Promissory Estoppel. It is seeking to enforce, use contract law, to enforce a promise exempting one individual from the public law. Specifically, appellant claims that there was a promise by a member of the Planning Commission to allow the use of a property as an airport despite a clear prohibition on such use in the city code. For that claim to survive, they have to prove at least three things. Number one, that a contract remedy could ever overcome enforcement of the public law. Number two, that a promise was made, even on this record, despite some facts, including the mayor at the time directly contradicting the Planning Commission's alleged promise. But number three, before we get to any of that this matter was timely. I was going to read the quote from Weavewood that Judge Johnson read earlier, but the Supreme Court has been very clear that whether this is an action for declaratory judgment or an action just under promissory estoppel, the statute of limitations is exactly the same. Further, there's Minnesota case law that's very clear that the statute of limitations for promissory estoppel applies whether that is seeking money damages or declaratory judgment or specific performance. No matter the remedy or relief sought, whether it's money or non-money relief, the same statute of limitations applies. That statute of limitations is 6 years.
You say there's case law saying that?
Your Honor, and that's cited in our brief, money damages from Jacobson, specific performance from Johnson, and then Weavewood for declaratory judgment.
So how does what happened, we went through on remand from Weavewood, the different claims that we decided were pure defenses to the foreclosure action versus those that weren't, and the ones that in the deck action, like, I mean, I assume you think we don't even need to get to Weavewood because it's not a deck action, but if this were, why wouldn't this fit the pure defense idea that they're not, it's not that's seeking any affirmative relief, it's trying to establish a right that you cannot, I mean, understandably, I want to know whether, in fact, I can use this as an airstrip.
Yes, Your Honor, so a couple of points. I believe you don't have to get to Weavewood for two reasons. One, that it's waived, and two, that it's not a declaratory judgment action. Assuming that the court does get there to address your question here, I think the difference here, so the court is clear that statute of limitations does not apply to a pure defense. They italicize the phrase pure defense. Pure defense is something that does not entitle a party to any relief. And so it's sort of, you know, looking to the case law, it's a purely a defect in the affirmative claim. So appellant cites to a case called Reynolds back from the 90s. So Reynolds is a paternity case. So the claim is that a man is the father of two children. The defense is no, he's not. Weavewood involves a mortgage. So the claim is that there was a mortgage on the property. The defense is no, there's not. Here, this is not, this is an affirmative request for, you know, for relief, for essentially a counter-injunction preventing the city from enforcing its code. There is no dispute that the code exists, and appellant has affirmatively conceded that the code bans the activity that he wants to do. There is no dispute that operating an airport on this property is against city code. Rather, what he's asking for is an affirmative, you know, establishing a new claim above the city code under promissory estoppel that would prevent its enforcement. And so that is an affirmative right to relief that has to be established. So that makes, you know, he's seeking essentially specific performance under this promise, alleged promise, not to enforce.
What if the city had, what if instead this case was initiated by the city bringing action against him based on its use? Would promissory estoppel be a pure defense in that case?
Your Honor, I still don't believe so, because again, as I've mentioned, it's not a defect in the city's claim. The city's claim is, you know, the city zoning code exists. City zoning code, as applies to this property, forbids airstrips. Period. We're done. That's all that, you know, that's the city's affirmative claim. There is no defect that has been alleged or briefed. In fact, it's been conceded there is no defect in that case. And
I'm asking whether in a different case, the
yes,
person could raise the defense of, I was promised that I could use this as an airstrip. If that's the only case, action by the city and the response is, I was promised, promissory estoppel, is that a, I guess I'm calling it a pure defense because that's in the framework of the deck action, but is it a defense that would be?
Yes, so cutting the onion pretty fine, as some mentors of mine have said before, It would be a defense if timely made. It would not be a pure defense because, again, it is seeking an affirmative right to relief. Promissory estoppel.
What's timely made if he sued and then he responds by saying affirmative defense, I was promised the ability to use that.
So promissory estoppel, to be timely made, promissory estoppel must be based on reasonable reliance on a promise. And so if it is reasonable to rely on a promise, then you can rely on that promise, you know, until the moment it becomes clear it's no longer reasonable to rely on that.
Reasonable reliance. Problem.
Problem. And so in 2007 is when the first time that appellant was criminally charged with operating an airport contrary to law. So in 2007, we have some arguments
if
we have time.
But that seems to go to the merits of whether you could prove promissory estoppel. I guess my question is, you got a complaint, you got an answer, it says promissory estoppel. Is that something that then could be litigated? Maybe lost, but litigated. Is it a defense?
I guess, Your Honor, I guess I would just be asking the court to accept that as a matter of law, it is unreasonable to rely on a promise if you have been prosecuted for doing the thing you believe you were promised. There's plenty of case law where the court has been able to step in and say that as a matter of law, reasonable reliance stopped, you know, at the latest at this point. So I think there could be litigation about, you know, was there reasonable reliance ahead of 2007? Although I think actually that might still be clear enough that we could say no as a matter of law. But in 2007, certainly it becomes, you know, as a matter of law, it is no longer reasonable to rely. So that is when the merits would be if it was reasonable before 2007. The statute of limitations issue is it reasonable to rely after 2007? The answer there is no, so the statute of limitations begins to run. There's a six-year statute of limitations, so that period runs in 2013. So the promissory estoppel claim here is timely at the latest in 2013, and this lawsuit is not filed for another 10 years thereafter.
Mr. Brooksbank, I was asking your opposing counsel earlier about whether the complaint was amended, was properly amended. Do you have a position on that?
Yes, Your Honor, and thank you for pointing out that sentence. My position would be that no, it was not properly amended. So what happened is we were at the hearing on the city's motion for judgment on the pleadings when it became apparent that there had not been a filed complaint. And so Judge Mieslow didn't want to rule on it if there wasn't officially a complaint in front of him. So the direction was to file the complaint. And I do not believe
direction
that there was
to
any.
Whom?
Direction to the appellant was just, you know, we had attached the complaint as an exhibit to our motion. It was one of the affidavit exhibits. But the direction from the court was, you know, appellant, you need to file this before I can resolve this. And so I don't believe that there was any amendment that was granted to that.
And were you there at the hearing?
I was there, yes, Your Honor. I wasn't arguing at that hearing, but I was in attendance.
And are you representing that there was no discussion about amending the complaint?
That's correct, Your Honor. So there was discussion about withdrawing, you know, that count three had been withdrawn and that there had been a request to withdraw count one. But I do not believe that there was any discussion of amending the complaint.
What I saw with respect to count one was a paragraph in the reply memorandum that says plaintiff withdraws count one. And that I think was filed before the hearing.
Yes, Your Honor. So it became apparent, it wasn't caught until we were at the hearing that the complaint had not been filed at that point still, because the city had filed its answer and that started the court file because the complaint had still not been filed yet.
Okay. So if I don't want to put words in your mouth, but if I gather your position is that a request for declaratory judgment was not pleaded in a count that is still in play.
That's correct, Your Honor. That would be my position on that matter, is that this is a affirmatively pled cause of action for promissory estoppel, and so that is what is before the court.
So I have a question. Is a permanent injunction impacted by this court's decision?
Well, Your Honor, as Your Honor noted, the permanent injunction was not, the city's affirmative claim was not appealed, because again, there is no dispute that the city code bans airports on this property. So the question is, does this claim, this alleged claim for promissory estoppel, overcome the existence and the plain and unambiguous text of the city code? As I highlighted in my argument earlier, I don't believe that it could, because this is a contractual claim seeking to overcome the plain language of the city code. And so I don't think, even if established, it could impact that injunction. But I do think that would be within the realm of things that the district court could consider on remand if the court went there.
But you don't want us to go there.
Obviously, I would request that you not go there. Yes.
Earlier, I think you construed or characterized plaintiff's claim as one for specific performance. I think you may have, in the same breath, used the word injunction, you know, that the plaintiff was seeking an affirmative injunction. What's the difference between either of those things on the one hand and a declaratory judgment or a declaration in an action in which a declaratory judgment is pleaded?
Yes, Your Honor. Again, it's a somewhat fine distinction, a declaratory judgment.
I'm not saying there is a difference. It's a little bit of an academic question, but I'm wondering if you see a difference.
Yes, Your Honor. To me, the difference is just the basis for the relief. So here, this is a specific performance claim because he's alleging a contract and he is seeking to enforce some performance under that contract or quasi-contract because we're in promissory estoppel. And so here, the most apt description of that would be for specific performance because that is the remedy based on the claim that has been pled here. Hearing no further questions, again, I would just finish a minute early here with, appellant started right off this argument with this is a declaratory judgment action, and therefore no statute of limitations applies at all to any declaratory judgment action. And I would just once again leave you with the words of the Minnesota Supreme Court, which said, quote, "We hold that statutes of limitations apply to a declaratory judgment action to the same extent as a non-declaratory proceeding based on the same cause of action." So whether this is a cause of action for declaratory judgment or simply an affirmative claim for promissory estoppel, it doesn't matter. It is bound by a 6-year statute of limitations from when the claim accrues. That claim accrued at the latest in 2007, meaning this claim is untimely, and I would respectfully request that the court affirm the dismissal of appellant's claim on the basis of the district court's order. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Vaccaro, you get the last word.
Thank you. I want to begin by noting that Mr. Brooksbanks is correct. It's not clear in the original complaint that the promissory estoppel count is being linked to a declaratory judgment action. But I want to note that the relief sought in that count is the relief specifically authorized by the declaratory judgment statute, which is an order construing rights. And that's an order saying that the city cannot enforce its ordinance against Mr. Walker. That's not, as Mr. Brooksbanks says, specific performance. Specific performance requires someone to go out and do something. It requires them to pave a road, cut down a tree. Specific performance is not in order enjoining someone from taking an action. That's why we talk about the difference between injunctions and specific performance. They're two things. And the labeling of the complaint is not what controls. The standard for pleading is notice pleading. Was the city on notice that Mr. Walker was seeking a declaratory judgment action? And it was because he was seeking an order construing his rights based on the promises that he was made.
Can I stop you right there? And I think this is productive. I'm looking at the prayer for relief, both in the original complaint and in the document labeled amended complaint. I don't see the words, the verbiage that you just said, an order.
It's in paragraph 34. It's poorly pled, I'll admit that. But I believe it's in paragraph 34 where he talks about he's seeking an order from the court construing his rights. Under the promissory estoppel count.
Yeah, could you pull it up and...
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. It's paragraph 37 in the original complaint under what's labeled count 3, promissory estoppel. This court should enforce the city's representations and allow Mr. Walker to continue using his property for aviation purposes at its current scope. So that's not a request for specific performance. It's a request to construe Mr. Walker's rights based on the promises that were made to him. And with the few minutes I have left, I just want to game out the situation here in regards to whether or not this is a pure defense. Now, the court uses the language pure defense to recognize that there are situations where an offensive claim and a defensive claim could be mingled together. It specifically uses the term pure defense, not an affirmative defense. An affirmative defense is a pure defense. No one is sued for assault and raises the defense of self-defense, and we say, well, that's not a pure defense. That's a total defense. to assault. The question of, and that's why the court uses the language pure, not affirmative, in describing the defense. It's purely a defensive statement here, saying you are promissorily estopped from enforcing this.
I would say that, I mean, I think in practice, promissory estoppel is most often asserted as a claim by a plaintiff, and I don't remember, I don't have a recollection of seeing it used as an affirmative defense. I think equitable estoppel is often used on both sides, but I guess it seems like with promissory estoppel, it seems like the most common usage is as a claim for relief by a plaintiff, and so I don't know.
But again, I think that's most common. There's nothing legally preventing someone from using promissory estoppel as a defense. Say that we have a contract about, you know, what you can and can't drag across my yard, and the contract says you can't bring a semi truck across my yard, and I say, hey, I need to bring a semi truck across your yard, and you say, oh, that's just fine, go right ahead and do it, and then I drag a semi truck across your yard and you sue me for ripping up your grass. Promissory estoppel would be a defense to that.
I don't doubt that. I would plead equitable estoppel if I were filing the answer. You know, I'll grant you one thing, Mr. Vaccaro, and that is, I think in your opening argument you said that, you know, declaratory judgment by itself is not really a theory. There needs to be some underlying theory, and I think you've got a good point. It's always kind of struck me as a little bit unusual that the Minnesota practice is that declaratory judgment is typically labeled as a separate count one. Usually it's count last. Mm-hmm. And I've always kind of thought, why isn't that just in the prayer for relief? Why does it need to be a separate count? And so on. But anyway, but in this case, you followed the conventional practice. You made it a separate count one, and then you dismissed it.
I agree, but I think count one was seeking a separate form of relief, and even if I dismissed it, what matters is what the other side is on notice of, you know, and what we're seeking. Oh, I see I'm out of time, so I'll answer your question.
Answer his question, thank
yeah.
you.
And what we were seeking was an order construing Mr. Walker's rights that's only available to him in the form of a declaratory judgment. Someone suing for promissory estoppel gets damages or something based on the breach, but they don't get a court order going forward that they have that their rights are this specific thing.
Judge Werke, may I ask one more question? Is there anything else you want to say about that hearing in response to Mr. Brooks Bank's representations about what occurred at the hearing?
I think that what occurred at the hearing, without having a transcript in mind as I reviewed it in my head as he was talking, I think there was some degree of ambiguity there about, I think Judge Meslow did want the complaint cleaned up. As I said before, the original complaint, not exactly my best work of proofreading. Some of the counts are misnumbered. I think that the reasonable minds could disagree as to the degree to which Judge Meslow permitted, if at all, it to be cleaned up. But I never moved, I'll be perfectly frank with the court, I never moved to amend the complaint. I simply filed it as an amended complaint because I wanted it to be clear that it was my view from the situation that Judge Meslow had wanted this cleaned up. There were some other errors that were discussed, and that it wasn't the original complaint that was filed, but it was the complaint that was filed based on comments from the court at that hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The matters are submitted. A decision will be issued in the statutory time frame. Thank you for appearing today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.